Hello and welcome to In Stitches, the upholstery podcast telling your story and inspiring others. Today, I'm really honoured to welcome Rowena Murphy to the podcast. Rowena, welcome.
Glad to be here.
So, as we always start the same way, did you know when you left school that you would like to work in upholstery? If not, what did you want to do?
No, when I left school, I wasn't even aware really upholstery was a thing. I actually had a place to study horse management, because I've been working with horses pretty much all my teenage years because we had no money and I loved horses. So I've had about 5 professional lessons in my entire life, which were birthday presents usually. So I just used to find horses that no one else wanted to ride and I would ride them because they were a bit wild or they were rescue or they were. So by the time I was 15, I was actually working in the stables, teaching riding and doing all the stable work, all this mucking out and everything and taking all escorting rides out. But I wasn't actually, so I then got the place to study horse management because I was convinced my whole life, I'm still kind of convinced to be honest with you, that that was what I wanted, but I wasn't allowed to do it, which is unfortunate. So I've had to think quite long and hard how to explain what happens at this period in my life, because it does directly lead to upholstery and how I ended up as an upholsterer. But I basically grew up with a very physically ill twin brother, very mentally ill brother and a mentally ill mother. So there wasn't a lot of my childhood that was about me and my needs. And most decisions that were made about me weren't actually about me. They were made for other people, for what was best for them. So the culmination of my childhood, by the time I was 18, I had a stomach ulcer from stress, had to decide whether to section my mother under the Mental Health Act. And 2 months after that, I was homeless for the first time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it's dramatic, I understand, but it does directly lead to upholstery. But at that point, when I was homeless, I wasn't street homeless. I was sleeping on sofas and, you know, sort of trying to find somewhere to live while I was actually at art college. So at that point, I decided I couldn't have what I wanted, so I decided just to do what I enjoyed. And I'd always been very creative. So I was at art college studying ceramics and metalwork.
Okay, so the path that's taken you on the career to upholstery, so tell us how you sort of developed that and went through that process.
Well, I always knew I was going to do a degree from about the age of 10. So when I was doing ceramics and metalwork, I wanted a design-based degree. I decided I didn't want craft, I wanted design. Oh, no, not design, sort of art, more art. So I applied to Camberwell College of Arts and came to London. And that was kind of my escape from things. And when I moved to London, I was intended never to meet. I never went home for holidays or anything. There wasn't really home at that point. And so I studied conceptual sculpture, which I loved. It's very conceptual based, lots of thinking and ideas and and I loved it, but I've always been about making things. I've said my whole life I just love making stuff. I've never considered myself a crafter, or I just want to make things. And it's all three-dimensional. Everything I ever made in my life is three-dimensional. So I would build. So for the first year, I built a giant grass valley, which is like this huge 6-foot freestanding piece of like wooden frame, which then had grass going right down inside it. And to me, it was a valley. To everyone else, it was a giant grass vagina. I kid you not. That's what it got called in the end of year show. It's the grass badge. But I loved it. I didn't care. I thought it was brilliant. And then, you know, things like for my second year, I built a room. And I built a huge, because I missed the countryside. That's where all the grass was coming from, the smell of the turf. I built like a giant grass bowl. So you walked into the room and then the whole room was grass, but it was a bowl going down. So you could go and lie in it. Yeah. And you're lying on grass surrounded by a very clean white room. And then for my third year, I built a 12-foot house that was 75 centimetres wide at the bottom and 1.5 metres wide at the widest point. And it had a real slate roof and it had a breeze blocked up window and it had real glass windows on the front. So I really like to build like these. And I built everything by hand myself.
So when you say you built this, what was its construction?
So the house, I mean, a lot of my stuff was like this, was wooden frame. So 2x1 frame with 2x4 on the bottom to weight it down, then boards on the outside. So it overhang. When you stood on the side, it would hang over your body. And then the roof was roofed with real Victorian slate that my friend had reclaimed from a job he'd been on. I actually got him to roof it because I was just running out of time at that point. And then there's boards on it and then real glass, like the windows, I made window frames, all at the right angles for the house. And the door, the front door was about 4 inches tall and the windows at the top were much bigger. So you the whole perspective was skewed.
Yeah. So you have real woodworking skills as well.
Yeah, I don't know if it's, I mean, yes, I do have woodworking skills after years of doing that. Yeah. But it's more that I've always been, I will think of something that I want to make and then I will just work out how to make it.
Yeah.
A really good example of the sort of child I was. I would make things in my bed at night with this, when I still shared a room with my brothers with a torch. And one night I decided I wanted to make a house. But all I had in my bedroom and probably in the house was paper, biro and sellotape. So I started by cutting out squares that I could then stick together to make a cube. As I was doing this and sticking them together, I realized I didn't actually need to stick all the squares together. If I drew the squares side by side, I could cut them out and fold them. And I made a house and I took it to school the next day and I showed my teacher and she said to me, what you've done is you've made a net. You've made a net, like we get taught how to make cubes at school. Well, in secondary school, usually. And you made a net. That's just what my brain does. I was just going to say, yeah. So, you know, I taught myself how to do something that I wasn't going to learn at school for another 4 years.
Yeah. No, it's been, but come back to the house. I know this is an upholstery podcast, but it interests me. What was the inspiration for having the house at this odd angle and everything?
It initially inspired by a relationship that just ended, which is a bit of a wild relationship. I was an art student, and I didn't see at the time how much it related to my own life. But it's about how we built things for ourselves. Like we built worlds and ideas and concepts about how life should be for us, but we can't actually access it because I couldn't get in this house. The door wasn't big enough for me. The only hole that would have been big enough for me to go through had the ugly bit on it, the breeze blocked up windows. The rest of it was pink and blue. So it's just about, yeah, how we build these realities to ourselves. You know, me in that relationship, very much that boyfriend was very much had this idea that after my degree, I was going to go and live with him. He didn't ask me about any of this. And he, you know, thought this whole world was going to happen and I was just not there.
So. Okay. So what sparked the change in the career? What actually got you going, I'd like to do upholstery? When did that happen for you?
Well, after my degree, I actually spent a year in France staying with some friends, breaking in horses. And when I came back, I decided after my degree for a bit, I decided I wanted to be a lecturer or professor, mainly because my professor recommended it, not because I really thought that's what I wanted. And so I started teaching ceramics at school.
Yeah.
And then after a bit, I started doing work for myself and I was doing decor work and event work and I was doing draping. And within the decor work, we would also, like, we would have to recover stool tops. Now, I wouldn't really class it as upholstery because for each event, they just put another layer of whatever that event's colour is, another layer of stretchy velvet over it and spray it with some FR stuff. But I really enjoyed that. And we would also cover, we'd do like stretched walls fabrics, like not as good as you would do in upholstery, nowhere near at that level because they're for one night.
Yeah.
And so I was doing all of that. And then that was most of my 20s. And then I, through all of this time, I still was moving at least once a year. I was not stable and I still hadn't found the way to prioritize what I wanted. I didn't even really think about what I wanted from life. I just was going from one thing to another that I enjoyed.
Yeah.
And I became more unstable. And I was seeking help for my mental health. But unfortunately, in this country, it's very difficult to get the correct help until you're in abject crisis. You get given tablets or, you know, this. And I was given an antidepressant and diagnosed with antidepressant. Only I didn't know at the time I was bipolar and the antidepressant caused the manic episode. So I spent a year and I spent 18 months being sort of manic and rapid spiking, which is when you go through mania and depression very quickly. It can be within minutes.
Yeah.
And I spent 18 months like that. And then I was homeless, I knew it was happening. It was just our tenancy and stuff was up. But because I was so unstable, I couldn't sort it out in the way that I normally would. I had all these ideas about how it was going to be. And I found myself homeless. And I was just, and I knew I was out of control. I knew something was majorly wrong. And most of my friends were telling me just to suck it up, you're fine. get on with it. So I really was trying to do that. And it just everything got worse. And eventually I was sort of crashing on sofas, and I hadn't slept for so long. I was just taking overdoses to try and sleep, overdoses of my medication. And eventually I realized I was on my best friend's floor, and I realized that I could kill myself like this, and that would not be fair to her. So at that point I had two choices. I either left and just went and lived a life on the streets, or I took myself to hospital. And I chose to take myself to hospital, which is one of the hardest things I've ever done.
But there's clarity there as well, isn't there? Because I think I don't have those issues, but when you're in those situations, it's very difficult to have the clarity of mind to think clearly.
Exactly. You don't have clarity of mind, and it gets more and more and more out of control. And the more people around you don't give you space to be unwell, the worst it gets as well, because you have to be unwell and accept you're unwell and have people accept you're unwell to actually get anywhere, to actually stop and try and get better. But I did. I took myself to hospital, this is a bit dramatic, but I volunteered to stay in the ward, and then they wanted to ship me across London to where I'd last been living. And I didn't want to do that, so I wanted to leave. And then they actually sectioned me illegally, and I was moved, and this is how bad our system is. I was moved across London without being told where I was going, with a security guard on me, making sure I went, without any information of where I was going, what was happening, or anything. I was just forced. I was just literally held against my will, illegally. So, you know, there are some major issues with our mental health service. I mean, I did need help, and I did, once I got into the ward and I spoke to the doctor on the Monday, I had the section removed, but that took over a week. And then I had to stay in the hospital longer because they won't, which is one good thing they do, they won't discharge you to the street. So you have to have somewhere to go. And then I did get on the housing list, and all of that was much, it was all the sort of help that I should have had. I should have had all that help when I was 18 years old, when I was first homeless and I was first dealing with stuff, not when I was 32. But yeah, it was interesting. Anyway, after a sort of 9 months of temporary housing, which is awful situations, I did get housed, and I got housed around the corner from an upholstery shop. And the whole being housed, and that being housed is a whole, like, that you don't look at the houses that you bid on. You're looking at an address and maybe one photo, and you're saying, okay, I will take that one. If you get offered it, you have to have it. So I don't know if maybe the universe was trying to be nice to me for a change, but literally, so I had to bid. I happened to bid on this house, I think one night when I was half asleep. I don't even remember bidding on it. And then I came to see it, and you have to accept it, otherwise you get pushed off the list.
Yeah.
And so I was here for about nearly, and I kept going past the upholstery shop, and I was here for sort of 9 months. And about 3 months after I moved in, I'd had a really good change of medication that really was helpful. And I'd got some space in my head for myself, finally.
Yeah.
And I was starting to think about, what do I want? Because I didn't even after I was sectioned, I didn't stop work. I was still going into work. And eventually I lost all my jobs because I was just falling asleep, because my brain was coming down from 18 months of not sleeping. And eventually I stopped. And I said, I actually just need to stop. I just need to not do anything but sort of heal. But about 6 months after that, I got brave enough to go into the upholstery shop. So, and that's where it started.
So I'm interested, you're walking past this shop, you're looking at it, and it's sparking something in you. Do you know what that was? Was it just the creativity, or was there something else going on there?
Well, I've been covering stuff in the decor stuff, and I've been working with fabric quite a lot in the decor stuff, and I enjoyed that. I've also been sewing since I was about 11 years old.
Right.
I've known how to use the sew. I basically had my nan's sewing machine from that age, and I used to make juggling balls and things like that. So I've always loved fabric as a medium, but I also had, in fact, you can see it's what I'm sat on now. I had an old... was a good office chair that I wanted to recover, and I had some, and I recovered that myself, and I was like, oh, that's done terribly, really badly. I didn't look at any YouTube videos, I just stuck fabric on it, and I did that, and I was like, that was fun. Oh, maybe I should do a bit of upholstery. So I just popped in to see them and asked, can I come in help? And he was quite kind. He was always kind to me, but he said, find a chair, a nice simple chair, and bring it in, I'll show you how to do it.
Oh, bless him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's lovely. So how did you develop? What was the process from there?
Well, I used to go in every day to help him out. I mean, his whole, like, he just opened that shop, but his whole life he'd been a job in upholstery for somebody else. So it was incredibly badly organised at every aspect of it. He wasn't, I know now, he wasn't even the best upholsterer. He wasn't terrible, but he wasn't amazing. And I would go in and help, and just all the little chairs with his scraps of fabric just start covering stuff. And then I also tried to help out by like reorganizing his entire workshop and just be useful. And then some and do his window display and, you know, that sort of, you know, I'm useful, keep me around sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I carried on, but he actually went bust. But he went bust by just walking away with a load of people's deposit and not showing up. So, and then the guy, and it was all a bit complicated because the guy next door had lent him money. So the guy next door kept the shop going while he was selling stuff off. So I kept going in and I started on my own to try and do a couple more complicated things, like a concave chair and a buttoned chair. And that's when I realized I need more instruction.
Yeah.
You know, I need more instruction. And I had to see, I sat down and I had a serious thing because like, do I want to do this as a career? Is this it? Is this like the one thing that really I've kind of been waiting for my whole life that uses all my creative and very practical skills that I could manage my mental health with, I could have my own business, or I'm in control and make actual money? So, because I mean, up to that point, I've pretty much lived all my life in poverty. And I decided, yes, it was. So I found the Shoreditch Design Rooms up the road. I went and chatted to Louise about what sort of course. And she was like, well, the professional course is the AMUSF. I was like, yes, well, I'll do that. Don't know how I'm going to get the money for it. So, and that's what I did. And, you know, and it was really difficult. It was incredibly difficult for me funding because...
Can I ask you about that? Can I ask you about that? Because I had a conversation with someone yesterday, nothing to do with podcasts, and that they were saying that they could not afford to do the AMUSF course. So how did you get funding?
Well, there is funding for it now. Recently, there's funding. If anyone's listening, they have got a bursary for people. I don't think I would have got it, but I did two, in the first year, I did two things. For the first time ever in my entire life, both my parents had a bit of money. They'd inherited separately, they'd been divorced, but inherited as small amounts. So I borrowed the money for the first course from my mum. And then I applied for something called what's a health budget, which basically is anything for your physical and mental health if you have a diagnosis that helps in your life. Now, it's not usually used for courses, but I'm quite good at persuading things. And I was able to prove just how much my mental health had always been better when I'd been in academia. Because of the structure and having projects, this is the other thing why upholstery is good for me, having projects and a loose deadline and, you know, having something to focus on like that naturally takes you forward. So they actually did fund half of it. And then I paid my mum back the other half. The second year, my dad, at that point, then he got an inheritance. So I borrowed it off him. And then I decided not to pay it back to him. He wasn't bothered by it. Because I realised if I added up all my birthdays and Christmas presents from the last time I got one when I was 10, probably covered the course. So I said, thanks, Dad. So I did, you know, and I've never in my whole life, I mean, I paid for my degree. I worked all the way through my degree. I worked all my summers. You know, I've lived at home since I was 18. Yeah. So I just, you know, and he is not, I mean, I love him, but he is not a very good father. So I just decided, you know what, I'm not going to feel guilty and I'll keep that. The third year, which was actually the conversion course at that point. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yeah.
Which is
maybe,
a nightmare.
Maybe explain that, actually. Maybe explain it, because I am, but maybe explain it so that...
So before they... Recently, they went... Before they went to 1, 2 and only 3 levels, they were 1, 2, 3 levels and the conversion. But if you had some upholstery experience, you could start on level 2. So you would do level 2, 3 and the conversion. But the conversion was only 6 months. You'd do 2 pieces in 6 months plus 1 practice piece. And it was a nightmare. It was intense. It was like just, we had Gareth for that year. He was brilliant, but it was intense. And it was personally very intense for me because I'm still like, it makes it sound like I've got it all sorted at this point in my life, but it's not true. I'm still being under-medicated and over-medicated. By the time I finished, I was so over-medicated that I literally could barely speak. I would have to plan my questions like an hour before I could ask them. So, yeah, so I think although it is more expensive, I do think it's much better structured now. My boyfriend's mum, I mean, this is like, I mean, it's lucky that it all came together. My boyfriend's mum actually lent me the money, which is now all paid back. I've paid back her. I was paying it back from the moment I got it. and I paid it back last year, which felt really good.
Yeah. So in that, whilst you were learning the AMUSF at Shoreditch, what were you doing in conjunction with that? Were you just concentrating on the course, or were you working alongside it?
I was working alongside it because I spent a bit of time in the workshop. It was really obvious to me that the course is great, but not enough. If you need more experience and get more confidence and everything. So I found, actually Claire recommended him because she used to work for him, a guy called Brendan. And I actually worked for free 2 days a week for 6 months. And then he started paying me for 2 days, but I would work a third day doing paperwork for free. And that was great for a while. But then when the work dried up with him, which was towards my second year, the level three, I started looking elsewhere. And then I started working for Ray Clark.
Did you? Oh, yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah.
Did you not?
No.
I worked for Ray for a couple of years, actually. Ray was probably my favourite person to work for because he's just lovely.
Yeah.
But after sort of 18, when the course started finishing, I mean, I love working for Ray, but I was getting great experience with like traditional builds. I was doing pretty much all of that for him, but I was doing very little top fabric and stuff. And I could feel my confidence with that slipping. So yes. I then started to try and find other places, which was a kind of blessing and cursing all at once. Because I also got a new psychiatrist who realized how much medication I was on, and I had to come off it all, and that causes quite a lot of instability in itself. So I was dealing with that and working, and I started, and then I sort of found a couple of other places in quick conjunction with each other, but they were good upholsterers, but they weren't terribly lovely people, so I'm not going to name them. But my anxiety around them really went through the roof. You know, it was really like, because I'm a very anxious person all the time anyway, you know, if you're going to purposely make me feel unsettled and inferior, you're not going to get good work out of me. You're going to make me so anxious that I do rubbish work. So after a couple of those, and this is now like another year later, I went back to Ray for a bit just to try and work out what I was doing. And that's when I decided to start working for myself, because my anxiety was so out of control. There was no way I was ever going to be able to go into another new workshop and not just be controlled by anxiety, which means I would do a bad job.
Can I ask you, because I hope this is a question that is okay to ask. Running your own business has massive anxiety issues around it, because sometimes you've got to pay bills that you haven't got the money for, or you've got a customer that's giving you a hard time. How have you coped with that? Because there must be a way you deal with that situation for you.
Very slowly. So I started working, because I was on benefits, which is no money at all, but I was legally allowed to work and get paid for 2 days a week.
Yes.
Minimum wage.
Yeah.
I couldn't earn more than minimum wage. So when I decided, I just started taking on, people would recommend me for jobs. And I just take on a job, let it take me twice as long as it should, you know, just take my time around it and see how it goes, and I just slowly built it up, basically. So I was self-employed part-time for 2 years.
Yeah.
And now you've got to remember, I was self-employed before I was sectioned. So I'm okay with invoicing.
Okay, fine. That's
right. So all that kind of paperwork side of it is fine. What was making me anxious was being able to do good work and interacting with clients. But I also finally, 6 years after I was sectioned, I finally got referred for talking therapy as well. And I've spent the last 2.5 years in therapy twice a week. That a lot of that is around building goals. So a lot of it is emotional goals and your emotional behavior and your emotional life. But to start off with, I was setting very practical goals. So with me, anxiety was doing two things. It was making me either jump in and make loads of mistakes, or procrastinate for hours and not do anything, or procrastinate for hours and then jump in. So I set a whole schedule. So when I watch rubbish TV to ease my anxiety. So I was allowed to get up in the morning and watch one program of rubbish TV while I did emails and, you know, whatever. Then I had to get going. And to start off with, I would forgive myself and let myself do two programs and then one. And for me, a lot about my anxiety was slowing right down, which it feels really, it's really hard. But when you're doing something like upholstery and you know to make money, you need to get faster.
Yes.
Right. To go in the opposite direction, because I was already, when I was at college, I was faster than everyone else because I was the only one working outside. And I had to go in the opposite direction, slow everything right down, try and think about what I was doing, how I would say things. And I did, I've done really well. I went full time basically January 2020. Excellent timing. And as usual in my life. But I had reached a point where my anxiety was, I'm still anxious. I'm anxious as hell right now. Yeah. But my anxiety is not controlling me.
Yes.
That's the difference.
Just listening to you, from my perspective, and I accept that it is my perspective, but it actually sounds like the upholstery has been a kind of therapy for you in terms of your emotions.
Yeah, in everything. I mean, making stuff for me has always been a bit of an escape.
Yeah.
But I really enjoy upholstery. I love it. I mean, literally, it feeds my soul.
Yeah.
I can't put it in a better way. And actually, just before I went full time, I started getting symptoms of fatigue. And 18 months later, I'm about to find out, I have official diagnosis, I actually have chronic fatigue syndrome. And I feel really exhausted every day, doesn't matter how much I sleep. But the best I ever feel is when I'm working, even though it's draining my body as I do it, my mind and my soul are so happy. And even if I'm exhausted at the end of the day, even though with the fatigue, I'm doing half the amount of, in 8 hours that I want to be doing, because I just can't move very fast, which is ironic that I get over that with anxiety and then I have this to deal with. But literally the best moments of my day is when I am upholstering, when I can ignore how I feel and I'm just problem solving and thinking about what's going on. Yeah. I love it. And I often look back and think, God, I wish I could have done the courses when my mind was more present as it is now. Yeah. But then I also am aware that I don't think I would have got to this stage in my life without doing the AM's USF courses, without having that focus and that love and that passion and that thing that I can go to as a almost security that, I have this thing in my life that I'm in control of.
But in terms of running your business from where you've come from, have you found that the system of running your business and managing your time, has it been a process that you've developed and learned, or was it something you were kind of aware of in terms of how you manage yourself?
No, it's a process that's still ongoing, to be honest with you. I mean, I was aware of, so I was au fait of how to be self-employed with taxes and doing a tax return and all those physical, practical things I was au fait with. But managing a business, especially managing a business that's good for my mental health and not bad for my mental health.
Yes.
So, for example, I'm still learning how to say no to jobs, which is really important for me. How to say no to jobs. And also, I still talk to a client on the phone if they really want me to, but I try and do everything by email because I can control that basically better when I respond. How I respond, I have a record. And it works not just for my mental health, but it also works when you have a dodgy client who's trying to tell you, but you said this, that, and the other. Well, if everything's in an email, absolutely don't need to do that. And like I say, it's ongoing. I'm still trying, finding ways, especially now I'm battling something else, the fatigue, which is still, I'm waiting for my official diagnosis next month. But there are now different ways I have to manage things. So it's kind of never ending. But then that is what I wanted from becoming an upholsterer, is the opportunity for me to do that rather than somebody do it for me.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about upholstery for a little bit. What has surprised you about upholstery? What's the thing that's sort of really excited you but perhaps weren't expecting about it?
Traditional upholstery. It quite surprised me. I didn't really have an understanding of traditional upholstery until I started the AMUSF course.
Yeah.
And learning, it's sculpture. Yeah. I don't know how else to put it. It's, you take the materials that really, really should not make a nice firm seat. They're all squitty, fibrous stuff. And what you do to them, how you stitch them, the hessian you use, the way you tack them, it creates sculpture. I didn't envision that when I started the course. I didn't envision either just how much I love it.
Yes.
I mean, I really enjoyed it, but I really love upholstery. And I also didn't envision so many things, like, I'm now doing things that are like pattern matching piping on curves, which, okay, I'm not really getting paid for that amount of time yet, but that's the plan eventually that I will be. There's so much you can do with all these materials You know, I just kind of see endless possibilities.
Yeah.
And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been discussed many times, I think. And that is the joy of constantly learning, I guess. So in terms of your business and not you as a person, well, you as a person, obviously, but your business, what are your aspirations for it? Where would you like to be with it?
Well, I mean, in me, I would like more education. So I'd love to do Gareth's and Greg's post AMUSF course. I discovered, I wish I hadn't discovered it because I want to do it so much, MA at Kingston University on sustainable design, which they look at, right, so they look at, it's very broad, you bring your own past and history and to it. So if I did it, I would look at the sustainability of the upholstery industry as a whole, because I think upholstery is naturally sustainable. And I think a lot could be done. You know, upholstery could lead the way when it comes to like the sustainability of like cottage industries and how to look at that. And I would like my business to be more sustainable. That's a bit difficult for me right now in the space I have. But the kind of upholstery work I want to do, also within that MA course, I would allow to do sort of a gender area when I would look at, and what I'd love to look at is the, because I think the upholstery industry is amazing. I think it is leading the way of equality for women in trades. And I think the industry and the people in the industry that have allowed that to happen and the women who are doing it is amazing. It's not happening in any other trade at the same level it's happening here. So I'd love to write a paper on that. But for my work, I really want to do statement. I do a lot of statement pieces anyway, but that's really what I want to go, sort of art as chairs. So I like to be surrounded by art. And I do a lot of it anyway. I don't really get paid enough for it. I kind of do it for the average rate at the moment, which is not ideal.
Yeah, you've made reference to this quite a lot. It's quite a fundamental issue within running a business that you have to make enough money to support yourself. How do you ensure that your desire to be artistic and perfect, and I hope I'm saying this right, but because it has to pay you, it has to return you a living. So how do you make sure that you don't get carried down a dead end? Well, not a dead end, but you don't get carried off in a direction that ends up costing you money.
Can I answer that question in about 2 years' time?
Yes. Of course you can.
Because I don't know yet.
Yeah, it's such I'm still part of business.
For me, I'm so fledgling right now. And I'd always said, even when I was on the AMUSF, I wanted to do statement pieces. But I also thought I might spend years doing it, just having to be a job in upholsterer, you know, doing grey and blue and whatever. But I've been really lucky. My clients, I get quite excited. My clients are quite brave. And, you know, I'd still do job and stuff as well. But, you know, so I've been lucky. So I'm like, so for me, I'm like, okay, so that's happening. I'm getting a portfolio of the work that I want to go forward to do. My prices haven't been great. At the moment, I'm going through and sorting my prices out. We are getting a bit of help from the journeyman. So we're getting a bit of help from the guild as a journeyman for that, to working out sort of traditional pieces, which is great. And there's a group with that as well. And also Michelle Kenyon-Roberts has been helping me a little bit with that as well. So initially I'm making sure I just get paid enough and not undercharging. But I also, at the moment, I have low outgoings. So I live and work in a council flat. So at the moment it's, so long as I feel like I stay focused on trying to get paid more for that, by the time I actually need to, I will be.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm still not exactly sure it will happen. I mean, we don't know, do we? Things. Didn't you just say to me earlier about something else? That's part of the fun.
Yeah.
Because you don't know.
But I mean, everything about it is a learning process, isn't it? So, you know, it's
yeah.
That is the joy. So what part of the skill would you most like to master?
All of it. Every single thing. There's not one bit of it I don't want to be amazing at. Thank you very much.
All right. Let's be more specific in terms, because I would imagine you wouldn't want particularly to master the skills of putting ply grip on.
No, I do. because all of it adds to it, right? I really do. No, ply grip drives me nuts because I've got to do some later. Because, you know, you put ply grip on not very well and you've got a wonky line, you know, and it dips in and it takes away from the finish. But what I really want to master is doing all of these things amazingly first time.
Oh, well, right? that will be your life then.
Yeah. First time, every time. I don't want a lot, do I? There's not really a part of it that I don't, because I just think every bit informs other bit. I understand that to make money, there's times that I'm going to have to go, well, that's just good enough. I get that. And I will never reach my level of perfection because it is unattainable. Every job I do, I've learned so much more that I think next time we'll do that bit even better. So I strive for perfection, but I'm okay with excellence. Because I think striving for perfection is great, so long as you're not beating yourself up when you don't get it.
There is an expression which is, you'll either love this or hate it, but good is good enough. And sometimes
I hate it.
Yeah, but sometimes you have to accept that, I think. Anyway, we always ask sort of people on podcast what advice they would pass on. So two questions for you. What advice would you pass on, and what advice would you have liked to have had as you were coming up through the system?
Okay, so for students studying and everyone in life, in fact, learn from everything. But I still look at all the posts on, I mean, not all the posts because I'm busy, but the posts on the forum, and I read comments to see how people are helping other people, see how different people are doing everything. I literally learn from everything. I learn from chairs I look at. I learned a lot watching other students doing different chairs in the classroom to me. And I would ask questions about their chairs. I did the same thing in workshops. If there's four people in a workshop, look at what they're doing. Ask them a question. You're learning. Don't think about, oh, if I ask a question, they're going to think I don't know the answer. You don't know the answer. Ask
That's
a question.
Why you ask the question, yeah.
Yeah.
There
so
is,
what,
there is
but also,
such thing as a stupid question.
No. Yeah. And then the other thing, so learn from everything and then always ask why. I think if you can understand why, and my good example for this is when you're being taught spring placement, ask why they're allowed to be a bit further from the back, why they're allowed to be a bit further from the sides. Why is that? Now, it's all to do with where your bum sits and the weight distribution. But if you understand that, then you can go forward and put springs in any, you know, configuration you want, so long as they fulfill the why. So, yeah, they're my two biggest ones. I don't know. I think what would I have liked to know? There's not really anything. I mean, obviously, there's a lot that I didn't know that I've learned. There's not really, because I was doing those two things quite a lot, learning from everything and always asking why. I think what I would have done differently is when I was studying, because I was learning outside of the classroom, when Louise would ask me, do you know how to do that? And I had done it before outside the classroom. I'd just say, yes. I wish I had gone, yes, but can you show me your way?
Yeah. Yeah, it's...
I wish I'd taken that on board, but I was just trying to not. I'm not very good at asking for what I need, so I was trying not to, you know.
Yeah,
do
no,
that, but I wish.
I really understand that one. I totally get that. There's a sort of an element of not wanting to waste somebody's time and feeling embarrassed, isn't there? And I've been in that situation myself.
For me, it's more. I have a real, and it's not surprising given my childhood. I have a real thing belief that I should just do everything on my own.
Yeah.
That I should just cope on my own with everything. It's not healthy.
No. It's not
anyone really listening, not. It's not healthy.
No,
ask for help.
Yes, totally, totally. So on that note, who inspires you? I mean, that's a twofold question, really, because it's also about, you know, sort of someone that's mentoring you as well as...
Yeah. I mean, lots of the women I know in upholstery inspire me. You know, sort of Michelle's quite amazing, and he used to be admin on the forum. But a lot of the women inspire me, not just because of their upholstery, but because of all the other things they do with it that they're coping with and dealing with. I found Gareth really, and I still do find Gareth really inspiring.
Yeah,
and a little intimidating. I mean, not him, but his knowledge.
Sponge.
You know, yeah. And I'm most inspired by people who just kind of have their head down, getting on with it. You know, they're doing all this amazing stuff and you're being awesome and they don't have any ego with it.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the reasons I love Gareth. He's got all this knowledge, but he doesn't really have an ego.
No.
And like, I only wish we'd had him for one of the year courses and not the 6-month courses.
Yeah.
We were actually one of his first ever classes.
Okay. Okay. So... moving on, can I ask you a little bit, because I know you're one of the admin on the Upholsterers Friendly Forum. Now, I'm going to ask you a slightly difficult question, so forgive me, but there is a criticism of the forum for it being not the friendly forum. How would you answer that?
Report, report, report.
Okay.
So, right? Because if a comment is not friendly, then it will get removed. Yeah. We also have a record. We keep a record. Anything that gets removed, anything that isn't friendly, is violates rules anyways, we have a record of every single one. So if somebody violates those rules more than three times, they're gone. If they violate it badly once, they're gone. But we cannot. It is like, I mean, I work full time. I have fatigue. There are tens of posts every day. We cannot check out every comment on every post.
Of course you can't, no.
And we can't. And tagging us in it is no good. You need if you tag one forum, one admin, none of the other admins see it. If you report it, everyone gets notified. It makes me as angry as it makes other people, because it's a minority of people.
Well,
it's a small minority of people. We won't talk about the demographic of them. It's a small minority of people who come into the forum because they want to feel they are better than other people. Mm-hmm. So they will comment in ways, you know, to a beginner, a learner, or even a newbie professional, in a way that is not helpful. It's not feedback. It's just criticism. Doesn't help in any way. And this is the thing that gets me about it. The only point to those comments are to make the commenter feel like a big person.
Yeah.
So all it does is tell the rest of the world that you're a tiny, tiny, tiny person.
I've said this before a million times, but I'm going to say it again, because I think criticism is a perfectly acceptable thing to have if it's done with kindness and a level of education and learning. But one person's comment is just one person's comment. So if someone slags you off and is really rude to you, it's always as well to remember that's just one person being unpleasant, and it doesn't mean that the whole forum is. I think that is for me one of the key issues with the forum is that there is so much good information on there. There is so much. I actually think there is a lot of friendly banter on there, but it's the ones that spoil it that ruin it. And I wish that wasn't the case, because I think it undermines the core value of the forum.
Yeah, I mean, there are,
it's
without
not
doubt.
No.
I mean, the thing is, we're up to over 14,000 people now.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people. Yeah. Try and monitor. You're going to get some idiots.
Yeah.
But you are right. There is something about not taking criticism personally.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody if one person criticizes you, like I said, if a person has done nothing, brought nothing positive to a comment but a criticism, that doesn't actually say anything about you or your work. It says everything about them.
Yeah,
and you should try and remember that, because if you can't, you know me, Robbie, I'm the sort of person who speaks out about things that need to be spoken out about.
Yeah.
A bad chair does not need to be spoken out about. It doesn't hurt anyone.
Yeah.
Doesn't hurt anyone. Not going to kill anyone. Even if it's for a client, if the client is happy with it, do you know what I mean?
But the other point about that as well is, if a chair is bad, but it's brought that person a lot of pleasure to do it, then who are we to cast an opinion? Well, we can advise, which is very different to being critical.
There's difference between criticism and feedback is letting somebody know how they can improve, but also letting them know how far they've come.
Yeah.
Right. So, and that, you know, when you criticize, you just generally say that's wrong. It's not constructive. There's nothing, you know, it's just criticism. So, you know, you can give people feedback. There's a nice long post that I wrote about how to give feedback. Willie wrote it, the dog, about how to give feedback. Anybody wants to read it. It gives you great tips on what to say. But it is, you know, if it's a bad chair and you can't say anything nice at all, just scroll on by. I do.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the sort of person who speaks out about everything. If there's any way I can help, I comment all the time. So if I can scroll on by to a bad chair, anyone can. But then, you know, just like somebody who takes criticism a bit too personally, that's about what's happening in their lives. That person giving criticism when it's not necessary, or, you know, just for the sake of criticism, that's about that person.
Yeah.
And you do need to try and keep it in mind, you know, people have their own stuff going on and their own dramas, and just leave it over there.
I agree. Okay. Guess what? We've come to that point of the podcast. So, it's the desert island bit, your book, your film, and your music.
The book is pretty easy. I would take Lord of the Rings.
Okay. Yeah.
One, it's very long.
Yeah.
Two, I have read it many times since I was 11, and I've always used it if I feel a bit unsettled. It's quite a nice book to hide in.
Yes.
So I've used that. Film would be Fifth Element.
Okay.
Yeah. It's I love Fifth Element. The supreme being that saves the world.
First time I saw that film, I was on an aeroplane.
Really?
Yeah. Long haul flight.
She's a woman. You know, that supreme being created to save all of creation. Female, which I love. I do hate the fact that she needs a kiss from a man in order to do it, but you know, I did. As a teenager, I was less aware of that. I was more like, oh, that's so romantic. As a much older woman, I'm a bit like, why does she need the man? But, you know. And then the music, I really struggle with a single album because I kind of would want, ideally, if I was going to a desert island, I'd want somebody to make me a mix CD. And I'd say to them, put how many on an album these days? 12? Mix me loads of 12 soul and funk music because that's what I'm into. But I would want it to be a surprise. Yeah. Which goes totally against my... I mean, you know, when back before pandemics and before no energy, I'd love to dance the night away, but I've never, even though I went to lots of nights, never into house music and stuff. I really like funk and soul. I really like stuff you can kind of move to and sing along to. But I'm also not really into pop music, but the funk and soul of its time was the pop music of its time. And it's just beautiful. There's so many things I love. Family Stone, there's just Aretha Franklin, you know, and it's all just really, really good music.
Yeah.
You know, there's literally, I don't think there's a funk or soul track out there that I've heard and maybe that isn't good music.
Yeah. I think we're on the same wavelength with that one. Okay. Well, thank you for joining me, Rowena. It's been really interesting chatting to you. And I wanted to invite you on the show to finish off the show because I started the show with someone who set up their own business. And I wanted to finish the show with someone that set up their business, the series, with someone that's finished their business. And I think your story is absolutely fascinating. And thank you so much for sharing with us. Thank you.
You're very welcome. I hope it hasn't bummed anyone out.
Well, yeah. It has. That's their issue. But it's been fascinating, and I thank you for sharing. All right. Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.